Hi, I'm Alyssa Milano, and this is Sorry Not Sorry. Often when white people consider racism, we look almost exclusively at what it costs people of color. We rarely consider the other side, what that racism gives us in unearned benefits and how that benefit hurts us as a culture. In her new book, The White Bonus, Five Families and the Cash Value of Racism in America, Tracy McMillan confronts this head on.
From slavery to segregation and discrimination to systemic racism, there are many forces which have stunted black wealth for generations. In fact, UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute found homeownership rates in Mecklenburg County continue to reflect redlining practices enacted in the 1930s.
As last recorded by the U.S. federal government, the median wealth for a white family in the United States was $171,000, and the median wealth for a black family was just $17,000.
The so-called alt-right is drawing reactions from the racially divisive beliefs some of its members are publicly embracing.
President Trump took his attacks on four Democratic lawmakers to a raucous campaign rally in North Carolina last night. His supporters chanted, "Send her back," echoing the president's racist tweet that the four women of color should go back to the countries where they came from.
I'm Tracy McMillan. I'm an investigative journalist and author of The White Bonus, and I'm measuring the cash value of racism in America, starting with myself. Sorry, not sorry.
Tracy, hi. Thank you so much for being on Sorry, Not Sorry. Let's start where we always start. Tell us a little bit about who you are and the work that you do.
Sure. I work as an investigative journalist and author, and I just finished writing The White Bonus, which is about the cash value of racism in America.
So tell us a little bit about The White Bonus. What is it?
The White Bonus is a subset of white privilege. So it's trying to take a financial look at the advantages of whiteness and how racism confers advantages to white folks in the U.S. And for me, this is not an algorithm. This is not social science. This is me sort of going through, starting with my own life and saying, okay, what kind of money has my family been able to spend on me after I left home? And how likely is it we would have had that money if we weren't a white family?
One of the things I really thought was important about this, and I love the term white bonus, because we talk about white privilege, and that's a term that many people hear and instantly react to, right? They say, well, I'm not privileged. I had a hard life. And they say that because they had that privilege, it means that they didn't struggle, right? Which is not at all what it means, but they don't take the time to delve into it. And so this bonus doesn't mean that you didn't struggle, but you get this quantifiable thing as, I don't know, as a function of your whiteness that perhaps somebody else doesn't. And so I think that puts it in this frame of when we look at racism and its effects, we often look at what it costs people of color as opposed to what it benefits us. So what do we miss when we don't look at these unearned benefits of racism to white people?
I think when we only make it into a story about oppression and sort of being denied, we miss a lot of the ways that racism actually functions, which means we can't ever really fight it effectively. And so I think about this a lot because obviously I want to be sensitive about not taking up space that, you know, I don't need to and not making arguments that somebody else could make better. If we don't talk about the ways that racism does actually confer advantages to white folks, we're never going to be able to address the ways that racism overall hurts a lot of people, including white folks.
You approach this work by telling the stories of several white families and quantifying the financial benefits they amassed because of racism. One of those families is your own. I think let's start there in the book. How is this relevant to your own personal story?
The way I measure this, again, right, is I just sort of went through my family history as well as my own and said, okay, what money did my family give me and where did that money come from? So when I start picking through my family's history, I say, okay, my grandpa helped me a little bit with college. I put myself through school for the most part, but had a little bit of help with tuition. I got a little bit of an inheritance later on and things like that. And once I dug into it, it's like, oh, really? Like all the money in my family comes from this one grandfather, all the wealth that's been built. So I said, okay, well, what did my grandfather have access to that only white people got? And when I dug into it, he had a racial covenant on his home. So he built his house in the 1930s and it included a provision on the deed that said only white people could live in that house. And if a black person had moved in, the neighbors could have sued. I mean, this was happening in the US at that time. If you had a covenant on the house, neighbors could sue and force a black family to move out. And so that prevented black folks from accumulating wealth, which we often talk about now. But also means my family was able to accumulate wealth. And then there's also a few other things, right? That particular grandfather worked as a banker. So I'm poking around in statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics back in the 30s. And at that time, there were only 80 black bankers in the entire country. Not only is my grandfather benefiting from this housing thing, but also from employment discrimination, right? So all of the money my grandfather had access to, he would not have been able to get if he wasn't white. And then that ends up compounding and over time and trickling down to my parents and then to me.
Were you able to come up with like a figure that you personally have amassed as a result of this?
Oh, I'm glad you asked, Ben. So the number I came up with for me was $146,000. And this is since I left home when I was 17. And that's adjusted for inflation, right? So the dollar amounts were actually different in real time. For me, something that was really fascinating is, you know, I'd been like, okay, I'm going to look at the like this number and figure that out. And I'll say it was bigger than I was expecting. Because again, I put myself through college. Most of my experience as an adult has been relatively low income. But then when I started looking at what I think of as like a social bonus, the advantages that society gives to me or the opportunities I get offered, doors that get opened for me, at least in part because of my race, much more valuable. The number I came up with there was $225,000.
I mean, that's really significant money, right? Like, and it's for some people, that is 10 years of work.
Yeah.
What was the number value? You open up that piece of paper and what is it?
Oh, $998,000.
Less than $1 million.
Less than $1 million.
Which means almost $400,000 less than the appraisal you'd gotten a year earlier.
Yes.
And so they applied for a new appraisal, but this time...
I'm going to guarantee that I'm going to get the appraisal that my house is supposed to get.
And in the United States, what is your best guarantee of getting the best rate possible?
Being white.
Being white.
Especially when we talk about the racial disparities. One of the things I think is interesting, though, about this is that you're a journalist by trade. And as a journalist, and I am not a journalist, but I understand one of the axioms is that you're not the story, right? The story is outside of you. What was it like to then turn that around and look at yourself as a subject of sort of your own reporting?
Yeah, I was real uncomfortable to start with, right? Not really my MO. Not only not my MO as a person, but my entire career is built on this idea that you don't do that. But when I decided, I was like, well, I kind of want to look at this thing about like, how does white advantage work and get a number for it so we can really get our hands around it and talk about it. Just on a practical level, I was like, you know, usually when I'm doing a journalistic story, right, I'm going to somebody to have them talk to me about something that I don't know about and I haven't experienced, and my job is to take these skills and reflect this out. And if a journalist came up to me, if a white journalist came up to me and said, hey, Tracy, crazy thing, you're white. Could you tell me about that? I have no idea what that's like. I would not be very open to talking with them, right? I mean, and particularly because talking about race is so sensitive in this country, and particularly talking about whiteness, which we almost never talk about, is so sensitive. I really just felt I couldn't really go to other white people and be like, hey, I want to talk to you about the cash value of whiteness. Nothing to see over here. So for me, it was also just like a good faith effort of working with other people and wanting to be like, look, I'm not asking you to do anything I'm not doing myself.
Another thing that was interesting is you profile each of the individuals and the families in the book in the context of a shrinking middle class. So tell us how that change affected the people in the book.
So when I started this reporting, my idea was to go up and down the class ladder. I have somebody very poor, somebody really rich, folks in between. And as I tried to find folks who would talk to me, it just became really clear over time that the only people who were open to this conversation really were white folks in the middle class. And I think that's because that's such a tenuous position and increasingly like unstable. And so I think white folks in the middle class understand that the system isn't necessarily working out for them, but they've got enough wiggle room. They're like, I could talk about it. I'm not endangering myself falling all the way down into poverty, which is a real steep fall for folks. But they also aren't so invested in the system the way that it is, the way a wealthy person would be, to not be some discussion.
Those voters, these shrinking middle class voters, and Alyssa, we've talked about this on the show a bunch before, when we're looking at these often rural, not always rural, but often rural, or certainly not what we think of suburban voters, right? But rural, generally poorer than perhaps their suburban counterparts. These are prime Trump voters, if we look at the demographics. And they have a term that we hear a lot around white resentment, which you talk a little bit about in the book. And I wonder if you can dig into that and just sort of explain what you mean by that to our listeners and how that impacts this conversation.
For me, you know, I came into this like at a fairly personal level, just because I noticed that the times when I had been most resentful, I come at this work as somebody from the lower middle class in the Midwest, like a relatively rural ex-urban background, right? So I'm not from the middle of nowhere, but I'm not from a city or a suburb. And so I found that the times that I had been the most racist, usually that resentment was coming from the kinds of hardships that I had, times I'd been told to be quiet and endure and shut up. And for me, that was more personal in terms of sort of abuse that was happening in my family and things like that. But I think a lot of that stuff extrapolates out into these broader political discussions. I think a lot of folks have really difficult lives, and then they get told, well, you just have to suck it up. And that turns into resentment. Now, I think there's plenty of reason to be resentful about the current political and economic structures we're living under. I don't think there's good reason to be racist. So I always try to be really clear about that, that when I'm talking about resentment, for me, I think often the political and economic resentment that folks feel bleeds over into racism, in part because it's such a ready story that gets fed to us.
But how do we, I guess, convince white people who feel this white resentment that it behooves everyone for them to let it go?
That's the million-dollar question, right? So that's a really big question for me, too. I think one thing to do is to just be really forthright about what racism costs us. And for me, that was the interesting part about this book and doing this project with the White Bonus, is that once you're honest about how much sort of whiteness gets you, you can also then be honest about what racism takes from us overall, too. Because when you're talking about the cash value of whiteness, you're really talking about the benefits of racism to white people. And as a white person, I can go out there and be like, you know what? Racism's just terrible for everybody, but does nothing for me, right? Like, in order to be authentically engaged in social change, I have to be able to say, look, this is a system that does have some benefits for me, and I don't think they're worth it. Because once you start quantifying it, you can frame this out as racism gives, but it also takes. And so I think for me, like when I'm talking with my relatives and folks that I meet in my reporting, I'm always like, I know that we get some stuff here. Let's talk about that.
What is white privilege? White privilege describes advantages and benefits people have simply because they are white. This privilege occurs on many levels in society. It is often not seen by white people because it's the experience they know. White privilege is interacting with the police and other authorities without fear of being profiled based on skin color.
Usually people will come along with you. They'll be like, oh yeah, that does help a bit. And then for folks that are open to it, you say, one way that I think about this is that it also hurts me going through that. It's very complicated. I think some people are just real dug in, and you have to be thoughtful too about like when you're not going to get very far and sort of let folks go.
There are politicians who are stoking this white resentment because somehow they think that it gives them a political advantage, which is probably true. In this very polarized time, what do you think the impact will be on the 2024 elections?
The impact of white resentment?
Yes. And how it seems that Donald Trump is actually, that's like his whole shtick.
That is Donald Trump's whole shtick, yes. I mean, it's been his whole shtick his whole life, too. I think something for me that's interesting, right? Like, I come out of an investigative reporting background. My mentor was Wayne Barrett, who was like the first reporter to sort of dig into Trump in New York and how racist he was and all that stuff. That man has been telling us his whole life who he is and what he's about. And then some folks have been like, yeah, like, I'm into that, which is complicated and terrifying. And I think the folks that's what they want, I don't know how to reach those folks. I also know that there are a lot of people that do not vote and are not engaged in the political process. And I actually think there's enough folks that are not engaged that we could bring over with good and smart targeted outreach.
It's funny. I was on a call last week because we're all gearing up for this fight. And people from the Biden campaign said that there was a difference in how it used to be. And I've been campaigning since Kerry in 2000. But what they said to me was, it used to be that we could, and this is true, we used to go out there and really just try to get people that didn't vote to vote, because those people would usually go Democrat, or the people who normally would stay home, even if they were registered, if you got out the vote, they would vote Democrat. Not so much anymore. They said that the nonpartisan messaging about voting has completely shifted and is basically because it's first-time voters are more likely to vote Republican because I think of everything that your book is about.
Right. Well, and also I will say I vote in Michigan and it's really difficult there, right? Because like Muslim voters and Black voters really don't, I mean, a lot of folks are just like, why would I go with the Democrat? They're spending all this energy looking at this vaunted white working class voter and they're not talking to me. And that's a real issue. That's not my reporting right in this book, but I feel like there's always this push and pull about, well, are we going after like the white working class voters or are we going after minority voters who have not been engaged or are we just taking them for granted? And for me, it's always really difficult because I hear these folks talking and I certainly understand the importance of keeping Trump out of office. And on an emotional level, I also feel like I hear what these minority voters that feel really disenchanted are saying because they don't feel the system's looked for them.
And if we didn't learn that lesson from 2020, and it always feels like we're playing catch up, you know what I mean? Where we're like, oh, so this demographic feels this way. So what's going to be our angle, you know? And I don't know, do you worry that some of them will see this work and say, see, this is what they want to take away from you with DEI?
I think people will take whatever they want from the book. And certainly some people are going to disingenuously take it and be like, oh, see, I got my bonus and I'm not giving it up.
To be sitting close to somebody who has zero respect for me. He doesn't believe in equality. He don't believe we should race mix, live in the same neighborhoods. That was very disheartening to me. First of all, let's get one thing straight.
Okay.
Do you believe in white privilege?
Yeah, white privilege is wonderful. I want to expand and deepen white privilege.
Part of me, when that kind of approach comes up, at least you're being honest about it. If that's who you are and that's what this country is, I don't support that. But if that's how you're thinking about this, my job as a journalist is to reflect reality, right? And to be honest about things. And I'm like, if that's where we're at, then I don't think the work that I'm doing isn't the thing that's going to swing the election one way or the other. At least we'll have been honest about some of the ways that this stuff is working.
Yeah. And I think going back a minute to that discussion that you're having about who the Democratic Party is speaking to, part of this is who's entrenched in the activism work that has been in the establishment activism work. I mean, I remember in 2020, we being in a discussion with somebody who said, no, we have to figure out how to get the white supremacists back on our side. And I'm like, no, that is not. This person wanted to have public debates with us. And this person has been established in this work for a very long time. And that's a fault in the Democratic Party. And we had blinders on when we necessarily shut down like coal mining in the Appalachians, but then put the job training for tech in Silicon Valley, right? So we didn't speak to people who are in this demographic that we're looking at, basically. We looked at white people there where we were ignoring them. And then we shifted and said, okay, now we're going to ignore people of color in this particular discussion. And we can't seem to get that balance right. But all of this kind of assumes that we have a zero-sum world that we live in, right? That if we address this problem of the white bonus, people are going to say, we're taking it away from white people to give to other people, which they're going to scream socialism because that's what they scream about everything. But I wonder, like, how do we deal with that myth of the zero sum where we could, in fact, maintain what we have and ensure that other people catch up to us, right? These things are possible. So I'm wondering, how do we get past that? Because I think that's the thing that people are using to manipulate this issue. They're saying, okay, you have this bonus, but if you want to address it, they're going to take it away from you, which is not, in fact, what needs to happen, I think.
Well, and I think, you know, one of the reasons that white folks can often be really silent about racism is because they have this implicit understanding that if I talk about the bonus that I'm getting, if I'm talking about the advantages that I'm getting, that means it's going to get taken away. This kind of gets linked to this idea that the things that white folks have gotten, that it's just what Americans get. Because a lot of the things that make up the white bonus that create it, it's actually just like a redistributive social policy. Like, it's socialism for white folks, affirmative action for white folks, however you talk about it. We created a white middle class with government investment and money. That was the New Deal. That was the GI Bill, all of that stuff. And almost all of those benefits were explicitly targeted to white people, if not in the letter of the law, then in the administration. And so I think the point to always make is to be like, this doesn't mean we get rid of Medicare. This just means we do it for everybody. And for me, something that was really transformative in doing the work with the white bonus was looking at the scale of what I had gotten, which was certainly much bigger than I had thought about, being like, if I got given all of that, then it only seems fair and appropriate that we would be giving it to everybody. Like, I'm totally bought in on the idea that in America, we are all equal. And if that's true, then we just have like a moral and political obligation to make sure that we actually are treating everybody equally. We treated my grandfather to be able to build wealth because he had a racial covenant on his house that was enforced by government. Then we should be figuring out how to make sure that same level of stability is available to everybody. And we can do that. But we often get stuck in this conversation about like, well, you're going to take away what I got, or you mean by saying I got an advantage that like, you're going to not give me like college anymore. And that's not what's happening. The idea is not only right to close the gap between Black and white, but also to raise the bar of sort of how far we'll let folks fall.
I want to get back to some of the people that you profile in the book. Let's talk about Jared. And I don't know if it's Bundy or Bundy. Tell us about Jared.
Sure. So Jared is a Gen X guy who, when he was 17 in 1994, had the bright idea to go to school with 8 hits of LSD sewn into the strap of his backpack, which he started selling around campus. And he gets caught on school grounds, gets arrested, suspended for a couple weeks, comes back, threatens the snitch, who snitches again. So he ends up with extortion, larceny, and narcotics on school grounds charges, and goes in front of a judge, and he gets a second chance. This is in 1994. It's the height of sort of punitive drug laws in a very punitive district. And so he gets to walk away and has to do a few things, do some community service and things like that, right? But he gets given the second chance. The sort of two things that are interesting there is one, that ends up saving him money because he doesn't have to pay for the first time he's arrested, they didn't even charge him bail. He doesn't have to pay for any of the sentencing fees or the things that go into incarceration, like commissary, phone calls, the cost of visitation for his family, all that stuff he gets to avoid. He gets to be out in the workforce earning money at minimum wage, at least, which in prison, like, you can work, but you're going to be making pennies. And actually, Jared went through that system right before the state of Connecticut actually started charging room and board to people who are incarcerated in that state.
On any given day in the United States, around 2 million people are being held in federal, state, local, juvenile, immigration, and other detention centers. But when you look at who comes under correctional control over a whole year, that number is closer to 10 million people, which is roughly the populations of New York City and Chicago combined. Now let's break that down. Of that nearly 10 million, more than 5.5 million people end up behind bars. 600,000 of those are sent to prison, and about 4.9 million of those are put in jail. Then there's the folks on probation and parole. which comes out to roughly 4 million people under supervised release.
So Jared, he ends up saving. He like earns more than $50,000 in wages at least. He ends up saving, I think, around $20,000. And all of that is without me trying to quantify the bonus to him of not having a felony on his record, which then makes housing and job searching much more difficult, right? So he gets to go forward. I want to point out, just because sometimes folks hear that story and they go, well, he should have gone to prison. And I feel like that is not the point of that story. You know, a 17-year-old who is like messing around with drug dealing, they deserve a second chance. And that's true for everybody. But at the time, if you were looking at youth drug courts, you would have about 2/3 of the folks coming into those courts were white and 1/3 were black. And when you start looking at who gets sent to adult prison versus who gets juvenile court, 2/3 were black, right? That gets sent into adult court, much more punitive, much worse for your long-term prospects. And then Jared, I write about this in the book also, then goes on, becomes a public health nurse and is able to become a homeowner in the Bay Area. And sort of then I dig into some of the ways that the property tax system in California ends up both helping his family, but also hurting them once they have a kid and start looking at schools.
So you talk about, and this, I think Jared illustrates this as well, you talk a lot about the shifts that you made between social classes in your life, as we define them economically. Jared was able to achieve this as well. He shifted into probably a higher economic social class, even than his parents were, I would say, with property owned in the Bay Area and whatnot. But certainly more than he might have been able to had he had a felony conviction. So in a dollars and cents term, how might this compare to the lives of, say, those black students who did get that adult court experience? And as we know, black people are much more likely to be incarcerated, to be charged, to be tried, to have longer sentences, all of these things. Like, how are his cohorts, are they able to make the same sort of social shifts in the way that Jared did?
Statistically speaking, right? No. So if you were a black kid in Waterbury, Connecticut's court system in 1994, going before the judge with drug charges at a school and extortion and larceny charges, the chances are very strong that you were going to get locked up. And Jared understands that, right? Like, he was talking with me. He was like, if I hadn't been white, he's like, I would have gone away. And then that changes everything about what comes out of your life afterwards. And so you go into prison with folks who've been there for a while, and so often can learn how to do other things that are going to get you back in prison when you get out. That happens a lot. You end up having a difficult time when you get out of prison getting a job, which is true for black and white folks in general, although Deva Pager did, you know, this wonderful study showing that being black in the job market is actually as much of a detriment to a black job seeker as much as like being somebody who had been imprisoned is for a white job seeker, right? So like that sort of stuff is functioning. So it's much harder, I think, for any black person who goes before a judge statistically to go through that and get out with a second chance.
What about just like the idea of time? Is there a white bonus of time? I mean, if we consider that a significantly larger percentage of Black Americans will be incarcerated, for example, or less dramatically may have longer commutes or need to work more jobs, is there a white bonus of time? And if there is, what might that effect be?
I think certainly if you're talking about getting locked up, all that time lost in the workforce, especially when you're young, so you don't have job experience yet and you're figuring out how to get a job and how to show up and like what you can do and all that stuff. One of the most powerful things you can do as a young person is just get a job and figure out how to be in the workforce so that then you can start building experience and meeting other people and then moving into jobs. If you're incarcerated, you're losing out on that. If you're somebody who has to commute really far because you're not able to live close to your work, which now is happening for a lot of people, you're spending all of that time not able to be with your family, not able to take a class to improve your skills, all of that stuff. So I think one of the things that having money, even a little bit more, can do for you, right, is it buys you time to decide what to do with your life. And you lose out on that when you're not able to have those earnings.
Tell us about the white bonus of gifted and talented programs that you write about in the book.
Sure. So this was a real surprise for me. I had not thought about gifted and talented programs as a tool of segregation until I was doing this reporting. But I was digging into a majority Black school district in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, where two millennial sisters, you know, their family kept them in the public schools. So you think, okay, great, like white family investing in the public schools, keeping that going. And one of the reasons that they stayed in the district is there was a gifted and talented program. Also sounds great, you know, and all four of their kids get found gifted and talented, so they're going through it. So I was like, okay, that sounds great. That's normal, like blah, 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 doing my research. Then I start looking at the demographics of the school and of the gifted and talented program. So this was an elementary school that within the district was functionally segregated because almost all of the white students went to this one elementary. So they weren't the majority of the school, but if you were white in that district, chances were you went to this school. And then 42% of the white students were in the gifted and talented program. The national average is 8%. So either there's some excellent water outside of Thames Elementary in Hattiesburg, or there was a sort of a funneling of resources to white students there. And then once you start digging into the history of gifted and talented programs, the founding basis of it was a eugenicist out of Stanford in the 1910s. That history is there. But then you look at when did these programs start popping up in American education? And it almost always lines up with when schools were being forced to be integrated. And that's true in North and South.
I don't want to wrap up, though, without talking about how policies aimed at punishing Black Americans can affect all of us.
As a 43-year-old Black woman, I have an intimate understanding of how it feels not to be believed by your healthcare provider. Hi, my name is Joy Altamare, and I'm Chief Engagement and Brand Officer at EHE Health. This is a word about how, when equitable and holistic healthcare is available to communities of color, we all benefit. I think in this country, we've seen specific issues around healthcare and people of color from the beginning of time. There's definitely what we call lack of awareness around how people of color feel, how they feel emotionally and physically, but also what they're coming to the table with.
I think that's really important. Who was Barbara Nathan Katz?
Barbara Nathan Katz was a upper middle class woman born into a prestigious family in Houston in 1950s. Her family white fled out of the city like a lot of folks did. And she had a difficult time in her family. Her sisters are pretty sure she was autistic. So she ends up, by the time she's an adult, falling into working poverty. She marries this guy, Mike, and they're living in increasingly sort of modest circumstances. They inherit a house from his family, and then they sort of move into like a residency hotel. Then they get into like a senior apartment thing where the manager likes Mike, so they cut him a deal on rent and all that. And Barb is basically supporting them on her wages at IHOP. And so they're living in Texas, which I think it's 9 other states plus Texas, does not expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. So there's no health care for working age adults in a certain segment of poverty. And Barb doesn't sign up for the insurance plan at IHOP because for her, it feels expensive, right? She's earning probably about $25,000 a year. So she doesn't know that she's diabetic, and she goes into ketoacidosis at home and dies. And so she pays this cost in a state that didn't expand Medicaid largely because of racism. So there's very strong social science tying an aversion to expanding Medicaid to very specific ideas about who deserves public benefits, being worried about white voters, white political leaders often using language around being worried about Black people taking advantage of these things that they don't think they should take care of, they should be have access to. And when I write about this in the book, I would argue my mother like paid a similar price for having a for-profit healthcare system. Barb ends up dying because we don't have Medicaid, and we don't have Medicaid because of racism. And you can piece that out through a number of other policies. I think one thing for me that was really interesting was looking at the decline in white voter and state financial support for public higher education as the student body becomes less and less white. So the GI Bill, almost everybody going to college was white, and that was free. You just got a college education. The boomers, a little less white, a little more expensive. Gen X, a bit less white, bit more expensive. And so now it's almost impossible to go to college unless you're willing to mortgage your future. And that reflects a lot about what white voters are willing to support if they think everybody, not just white people, but everybody will benefit from it.
And you're working on a white bonus estimator, is that right? How will that work?
I am. We'll see how it goes, right? It's very complicated, but it would sort of be a set of questions, right? This is very much a gamified online idea, right? That there would be a few sort of quiz pages, basically. And then if people knew, I'd walk people through the same calculation I do for myself, right? How much money did you get from your family? What kinds of policies did your family have access to that were really only able to enrich white people? And then also in your life, what are some things that may have affected you financially in terms of your race? So because there's so much rich data and research on those financial gaps, usually framed as Black hardship, what I do is I turn it around and say, this is actually about white advantage. And you can often pull out numbers for that stuff.
So finally, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope? That's a good question. There's sort of two answers, right? One, I'm a journalist. My job is not to give you hope. My job is to give you facts. But I do feel hope because this is a human-made problem. And as long as it's a human-made problem, humans can fix it. A lot of times when I'm talking to people about this white bonus, people are like, well, what do I even do? Like, well, how do I fix this? And I'm like, the way that we fix this is we work to end racism. And there are things we can do about that. If you belong to a union, you can talk to your union about making sure that racial equity is part of that. Even if you're white, it's fine to say as a white person, I think that's important. I'm not going to get hurt by being more inclusive there. Or working around affordable housing and being okay with there being rental units in a development, things like that. There's lots of things that we can do. We just have to decide that we want to do it.
Tracy McMillan, you give us hope. Thank you so much for the work that you do and for being part of our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
So when you see the word white, what comes to mind?
Privilege, I think power, access, luxury.
A race, some good, some bad. Can't be critical of all whites, but there is a strong element of racism in white Australia.
I think of Iggy Azalea and Miley Cyrus.
White is a way of being, doesn't always mean skin color. It's a way of thinking.
When I think about white, I think about maybe a group of people who I would love to be in harmony with, but don't always feel like they feel the same way towards me.
White, run, controlled, system.
Not understanding. They don't acknowledge what has happened in the past.
So often the right wing complains about woke or DEI as something which costs white people something. And maybe in the most twisted possible way of looking at diversity, equity, and inclusion, that could be considered vaguely true. But what it might cost is something we never earned in the first place. And that by keeping it, we cost other people things that they should earn. The white bonus, as Tracy calls it, hurts us as a culture and as a nation. I hate that those bad faith politicians are stoking and manipulating white resentment as a political tool in this year's election. Shouldn't we finally be at a place where being overtly racist is a detriment to someone's political aspirations? The fact that so many Republicans are leaning into it tells me all I need to know about them. And I hope we all tell them that at the ballot box this fall.
Sorry Not Sorry is executive produced by Alyssa Milano. That's me. Our producer is Ben Jackson, audio editing and engineering by Maciej Lewandowski, and music by Josh Cook, Alicia Eagle, and Milo Bugliari. Don't forget to rate, review, and spread the word. Sorry, not sorry.